George News Radio. I'm Carl Lamar.
Are we getting older, or is the supermarket suddenly playing great music? The Kate Daly Show starts now.
Americans yearn to explore life's deepest truths and to say their entertainment, or their idea of entertainment, is sex and violence and crime is an insult to their goodness and intelligence. We are people who believe love can triumph over hate, creativity over destruction, and hope over despair. And that's why so many millions hunger for God's good news. I've always believed that we were, each of us, put here for a reason, that there is a plan, somehow a divine plan for all of us. And I know now that whatever days are left to me belong to Him. I also believe this blessed land was set apart in a very special way.
Hi there. I concur. I totally agree. It was great. Welcome to the Kate Daly Show. So glad to have you listening in. In fact, I'm going to do something a little different this hour. So once in a while I do this, and sometimes I need a break from politics. I'm not even going to mention Romney's competing bill with Mike Lee for the same family leave act dipping into Social Security. See, I'm not even going to mention it. You know what? You know what we're going to do? We're going to have kind of a different hour. And then in the national show, I have investigator Dave back for a show, and we're going to be talking about all kinds of down the rabbit hole. I mean, well, not really down the rabbit hole. Some of it is. But it's going to be about Venezuela, and it's going to be about global politics. What's going on in Haiti, Colombia, all of the things that we really need to be aware of. So I'm actually excited to hit all of these things with investigator Dave today. And I also wanted to mention, too, I've gotten my car done at Auto Body Central. Auto Body Central is, well, they're family owned, they're amazing, and they're honest, and they do good work, and they do it for the best price. If you are in an accident and you need body work done on your car, if you need something else, if you're struggling with something with your vehicle, give them a call. I highly recommend them. I used them myself, and that's why I talk about them on the show. But I also have friends that use them too, and that's how I heard about them, and they really are that good. When the insurance company tells you know, here's two places to go get your car fixed. Actually, you don't have to go to those two places at all. You can choose Auto Body Central, because they're just that good, and they'll do it for the best price, and they'll get your car back to you, and it'll look perfect. The number there is 817-0949, and if you have a question about anything you have wanted to get fixed in your car, call them, because they'll tell you whether they can do it or not. And I just love these guys. They're just good. They're just good, you know? StGeorgeAutoBody.com, StGeorgeAutoBody.com. I would like to share a couple of stories with you. And a couple of these come from The Moth. Interesting for different reasons for me. And the first one I want to share is a doctor's visit over to India. And the way he tells the story is just comical. And stories strike me for different reasons. I learn different things from them. And I'm sure you're the same way. And sometimes it's kind of refreshing to hear somebody, an experience from somebody's life, and you take that experience, and it really can help you to see things differently, or just relax a little bit and enjoy somebody telling a story from their life. And this is a true story from Dr. Lombardi's life that I found so funny, and I wanted to share this with you. And this is his trip to India. This is George Lombardi. Enjoy.
It was a Saturday afternoon in September 1989, and I was home alone unpacking boxes when the phone rang, and a woman that I did not know started to interrogate me. Are you Dr. Lombardi? Are you Dr. George Lombardi? Are you an infectious disease specialist? Did you live and work and do research in East Africa? Are you considered to be an expert in tropical infections? Would you consider yourself to be an expert in viral hemorrhagic fevers? At this point, I paused and I gathered myself. And I asked the obvious question, who are you? She introduced herself and said she was the representative of a world figure and a Nobel laureate, someone who was suspected to have a viral hemorrhagic fever, and she was calling to ask if I would consult on the case. Now, I found this highly improbable. I was 32 years old. I had just opened my office. The phone never rang. I had no patience. In fact, I remember staring at the phone, trying to will it to ring. But she persisted, and she mentioned that she had gotten my name from a colleague of mine who had told her to call Dr. Lombardi. He knows a lot about very weird things. She arranged a conference call, and in 10 minutes, I was transported through the telephone wires to a small hospital in Calcutta, India, where I found out for the first time that the patient was Mother Teresa. And on the line were her two main Indian doctors. We chatted and discussed the details of the case for about an hour, and though those details are now hazy to me, what came through the staticky wires was their deep, abiding concern for their patient. These guys were worried. I wished them well as I got off the line, and I went back to unpack some boxes. She called an hour later. She said they were very impressed by what you had to say, and they'd like you to go to Calcutta. I'm making the arrangements. I can get you out tomorrow afternoon on the Concorde for the first leg. I said, this is impossible, as I had just found my passport in one of these boxes, and I told her it had expired 3 months before. She said, that's a minor detail. Meet me in front of your building tomorrow morning, Sunday, at 7 a.m. Well, as you can probably surmise, I'm somebody who pretty much does what he's told. So 7 o'clock the next morning, she comes careening down the block in a wood-paneled station wagon with bad shock absorbers. I jump in. The next stop's the passport office at Rockefeller Center, where on a Sunday morning, a State Department official came, let us in, took my picture, and handed me, in 15 minutes, a brand new passport. The next stop was the Indian consulate, where again, on a Sunday morning, the entire staff came in full dress uniform to give me an honor guard procession, which I walked past as they ushered me into the consul general himself, who affixed the visa to my passport. He leaned in towards me and said, "We bestow our blessings on you. The eyes of the world are upon you." Now, I knew who Mother Teresa was, of course, but this was my first realization in finding out what she meant, not just to the world, but to the Indian people. I get back in the car. I'm getting into this. What? Where next? She says, "We're ahead of schedule. I'm going to drop you off. I'll be back at 11 a.m. I'll meet you downstairs." Sure enough, 11 a.m., tires squealing, she pulls up. With one addition, in the back seat of the station wagon are wedged five Sisters of Charity. Five nuns as if sitting on a perch. They start handing me letters and envelopes and small packages wrapped in burlap and tied with twine and handing me these things and saying, "If you see Sister Narita and Sister Raphael, please give her this from me. I'm a courier." This is all before Homeland Security. We barrel off to JFK, and when we get there, I ask sotto voce, "Why are the nuns here? They could have just given you these things. I don't understand why they had to come to the airport." And I was told, "Well, I didn't know how to tell you this, but you don't have a confirmed seat on the Concorde. You're flying standby." So my eyes widened. "Well, the sisters are going to go up and down the line of ticketed passengers and beg until someone gives up their seat." I stood off to the side as I watched this scene unfold just out of earshot as these five nuns surround this first New York City businessman. He's listening to them. He's looking over at me. He's looking back at them. He shakes his head no. He's sorry he can't help. They move on to the next one. And now I can hear their voices, which obviously have been raised. And in about 15 seconds, he realizes that resistance is futile, and he hands over his ticket. They come towards me, and they hand me this ticket as an offering. And they have small, triumphal grins on each of their faces, the non-equivalent of a high five. I wag my finger at them. I said, "You sisters are little devils. I'm going to tell Mother Teresa what you just did." And they laughed, and that broke the tension. Next stop, Calcutta, 24 hours in flight, 100 degrees, 100% humidity. I get off the plane, and I'm met by my own personal private security detail of nuns. They whisk me through customs and deliver me directly to the hospital where the doctors are waiting for me, and they intone, "She's deteriorating." I go directly to her room. I'm meeting Mother Teresa for the first time. She's clearly very weak, and she beckons me towards her, and I feel as if I'm about to get a blessing. And she says the following, "Thank you for coming. I will never leave Calcutta. Do not ever disagree with my Indian doctors. I need them. They run my hospitals and clinics, and I will not have them embarrassed." And with that, she dismisses me with a wave of her hand. I go and wash my hands, and I come back to examine her. As I go to pull her down gown to listen to her heart and lungs, the nuns that surround her lift the gown up. I pull the gown down, they pull the gown up. This kabuki dance goes on for several minutes, until from clear exhaustion, I just banish them from the room. After I perform my examination, I still don't know what's wrong with her. And we agree we'll meet the next morning at 9 a.m. As I leave the hotel, I'm set upon 5,000 pilgrims who are holding a candle-lit prayer vigil. I escape back to the hotel and order room service for dinner and turn on the local news, hoping it will serve as a distraction.
All right. I'm going to come right back, the rest of the story, when I come back on the Kay Daly Show. Sometimes it's really nice to hear somebody's experience, and he is just, he's just a crack up. This is Dr. George Lombardi telling this story that actually happened. And the rest, when we come back, I have a couple others for you, too. Things that have just sort of touched me and I've thought about after listening to, thought I would share with you today. Get a little break from politics today. Investigator Dave will join me next, but be right back.
Talk lines are open now. Call 888-673-1450. This is the Kate Daly Show.
Welcome back. Kate Daly Show. Taking a little break today, going in a different direction. And I want to share this with you, this funny story. Dr. George Lombardi found himself as a very young scientist. Well, he was a scientist, also infectious disease doctor, and he was found out that he was flown to India, and he was the guy that is supposed to save Mother Teresa's life. And what ensues after this? And so I'm sharing some stories with you in this hour. Investigator Dave will come on in the national show. We'll be talking a lot about geopolitics today and really getting to the bottom of some understandings that we all need about, I think, that we all need about global politics right now and what's going on. There's so much there to talk about. So let me finish this story with Dr. Lombardi telling the story about that he found himself. He had just met Mother Teresa and doesn't know what's wrong with her. And he finds himself back in his hotel room, and he just finally realizes, oh my gosh, I'm life or death for Mother Teresa, and I didn't even know I would be doing this. So here is the rest of George Lombardi telling this story. Here you go.
As I leave the hotel, I'm set upon 5,000 pilgrims who are holding a candle-lit prayer vigil. I escape back to the hotel and order room service for dinner and turn on the local news, hoping it will serve as a distraction. And there I am. The lead story on the evening news, that night and every night, footage of Dr. Lombardi entering and leaving the hospital, with the reporter saying, "Dr. Lombardi's come from the United States to attend to Mother Teresa as she inches closer towards death." She deteriorates over the next 48 hours. She's in septic shock, the rude unhinging of the mechanism of life, as it was described 150 years ago, as apt a description now. And on the third day, two propitious events collide. The first is the most beautiful sight I've ever seen. Small, tiny, translucent dewdrops on the blood culture plate. This is important. This could be a bacterial infection. This is an important clue. And the second is the Pope's cardiologist flies in from Rome. He's an impressive man, straight from central casting. A head of silver hair, a Brioni suit, Hermes tie, Gucci loafers. And at our first meeting, when I tell the group of doctors excitedly that the cultures are turning positive, we may have an answer here, and my concern is that a pacemaker that was put in several months before could be the cause of the infection, he erupts Vesuviously. "Out of the question," he bellows. "This is a clear case of malaria." Well, if they could diagnose malaria anywhere, it would be on the subcontinent of India, and this wasn't the case. She worsens over the next couple of days, and I'm having dreams where she's actually falling just beyond my outstretched hand. And I change my routine. Rather than fleeing the hospital at the end of the day through the side exit, I go out through the front, and I walk through the pilgrims, and I'm bolstered by their love and their devotion. On the fifth day, I make my most impassioned plea. I stand before the group, and I tell them that this is septic shock, it has a bacterial cause, and it's due to the pacemaker. This pacemaker must be removed. Dr. Brioni, as I've come to call him, stands at the lectern carrying his copy of the Merck Manual. It's a small book that many doctors carry. He has the Italian version, Merck Manuale. And in a scene right out of Shakespeare, as he talks, he's pounding the lectern. "If you listen, boom, 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 to this American upstart, boom, I will not be held responsible. Boom." And the sounds ricochet through the somber conference room like gunshots. And in that moment, in that instant, I looked into the eyes of the courtly, elegant Indian doctors, and they had lost respect for him. They asked us to wait outside as they considered their options. I sat there with my vinyl knapsack and my socks with sandals. He sat next to me, elegantly attired, with two equally elegantly attired attachés from the Italian consulate. They called us back in and said, "We've decided to go with Dr. Lombardi." He silently packed his bag, left the hospital, went directly to the airport, and flew out of the country. I said, "Let's get that pacemaker out." And they looked at me. "You want it out? You have to take it out." I said, "I've never done that before." They gave me this wonderful, nonverbal Bengali head waddle, like... So I went down to her room. I banished the nuns. I got a charge nurse and a basic tray, and I prepared the patient. The pacemaker box came out readily, but the wire that had been sitting in her right ventricle for several months was tethered into place and it would not budge. I twisted and turned and did all kinds of little body English, and this thing was stuck. I started to sweat. My glasses fogged over. There have been stories, if you pull hard enough, you can put a hole in the ventricle and she could bleed into her chest and die within a matter of minutes. So in the most surreal moment, I said a prayer to Mother Teresa for Mother Teresa. and this catheter came loose. Thank you. I took it out, I cultured the tip, and I proved that this pacemaker was the cause of her infection. She got better. Her fever broke. She woke up. A couple of days later, she's sitting in a chair, eating. My work was done, but they wouldn't let me leave. I stayed another 2 weeks, as I was the only doctor who could start her IVs, who could thread these catheters into these tiny, fragile, elderly woman's veins. When it was my time to leave, they held a press conference and they publicly thanked me. And that's why I'm able to tell this story. She lived another 8 years and I saw her periodically. But the best part of this for me is that I have an ongoing relationship with the sisters. And the other sister says to me, "Dr. Lombardi, in the convent, we think of you as a rock star."
Dr. Lombardi, his story, Mission to India, just so cute. You know, I was thinking about that story, and the reason that it you know, just had a little bit of an impact on me was how many times we all find ourselves in situations where you just think, you know, you can't do something, or you, all of a sudden you find yourself where you find yourself playing a role, or you think, well, my gosh, your insecurities come out. And his story about being so young and not having patience, and then all of a sudden you're working on, in his case, for Mother Teresa, and how the whole country's eyeballs were on him. And I can't imagine that kind of stress. We were talking global politics today, and so this is why I'm sharing this with you. Moran Cerf told a story about the fact that, and he's got a tough accent, and that's why I hesitate playing it on the show, because I don't know that accent it'll be hard to listen to. But I was thinking about the media with this particular story and how it spins out of control so easily. And in his case, what happened was he was published as a young scientist. And this is something, he was published in Nature, which is a hard thing to get your work into Nature. They go over it for 6 months to a year. And if you've done something then noteworthy, worth publishing, this is kind of like what makes your career as a scientist. And he's real young. And so he was excited because he had done some brain studies where they were able to, and he had spent a lot of time doing this, where the pictures that the person thought of, they could project on a screen. And he gets accepted into Nature's magazine. He's really excited. He's telling everyone he knows. And he decides that he would like to do a video accompaniment with this because he needs to describe to people the research he just did. The mention in Nature wasn't going to be enough. He wanted to make sure there was something visual to see. So he constructs a video. And at the very end of the video, in the last second of the video, and he says, "Boy, wouldn't it be great if this could ever tell us what dreams do?" Well, the day that this press release was going out and his work was to be published and there was going to be press releases to the media, all of a sudden his phone starts ringing off the hook. And the media picked up on the story that he could read dreams, even though that's not what his research was about. All his research was about seeing a picture on a wall of a thought. It wasn't about dreams. So all of a sudden, every single, from BBC to you name it, CNN, everybody's calling him and wanting a comment. Articles are coming out that say that he has done this. The scientists that have been working on that knew that he hadn't done it because they hadn't even done it. So it had not even been invented. And he kept saying, but it wasn't invented. It hasn't been invented. This is, and every single news outlet carried the same story. You know how we talk about the media all the time, just perpetuating whatever they're fed through the AP. So it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And Microsoft was calling him, and all of these huge companies were calling him and saying, "We want an option to buy what you've just done." And he's saying it doesn't even exist. And they're saying, "Oh, you're just being modest. You're just being modest. You're just playing hardball. We'll up the ante." And it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. and he finds himself meeting with the Christopher Nolan, who did the movie with Leonardo. Inception, or I can't remember. I can't remember the name of the movie. It was about dreams, and he goes, you know, I want you to travel around. You're the face of this, because during all of this, he had gone to a Halloween party to get his mind off the fact that everyone was not portraying his work accurately, and they weren't giving him the props they should have given him, and he was basically felt like he was living a lie, because they all thought that he had this new dream invention where he could actually go in and decipher dreams. So he dressed up as Freud for a Halloween party, and the picture got in the press because it got all over Facebook. So there's a picture of him dressed as Freud with this dream invention, and he is wondering, well, how am I ever going to squash this story? And this went on for months. And he could not live it down. He couldn't get anyone to listen to him. In fact, he kept telling everybody, that isn't true. And they kept saying, it's okay. No one will care. No one will care 6 months from now. So we're just going to go with the story as is. Yeah. Can you believe that? So they kept perpetuating the story in the press, and nobody fixed it. Nobody retracted it. Nothing. And to this day, he still gets comments. And Christopher Nolan even said, hey, I don't care that you didn't do it. You know what? Just travel with me. You're just the face of this thing already. So, you know, if it's not invented yet, that's okay. We'll just kind of lie. And he sat there and he said, I had to make a decision. Do fortune and fame, or do I just tell the truth and back out? He told the truth. He backed out. But I thought about that story for a long time, because I thought, you know, the media, they didn't care about the truth. They simply did not care. And he kept trying to correct the story, and they wouldn't correct it. And to this day, he is known as the guy that invented something that can decipher dreams, even though that he never did. Anyway, I'll be right back. I have one for you when we come back. Kate Daly Show.
Talk lines are open now. Call 888-673-1450. This is the Kate Daly Show.
Welcome back. Kate Daly Show. Glad you're joining me. Just a little switcheroo for this hour. Just some stories for you, and I'm hoping you're enjoying your Friday. We're going to be talking global politics with Investigator Dave. He's back for a visit, and so he'll be on the show today on the national show. And just wanted to mention one more time, Defending Utah, defendingutah.org. Please get over there and get some materials from them. They've got some wonderful things to be able to make sure that you know how to be a better watchdog over the things that are happening in the legislature, knowing that also just sort of understanding how to deal with the legislature now as they sort of change their pace a little bit in going for so much legislation and, you know, all kinds of things, the shenanigans that they're doing. So just so that you know what's going on, also become a member and support them, because we need them. They're one of the only journalism bodies that I know that strives just to tell the truth. And I love that about them. And they do that within the state of Utah. They're so great. So please make sure that you're supporting defendingutah.org. And they have so many great things for you as well. So there's newsletters, behind the scenes things, and then also they have terrific DVDs and all kinds of things that will really help you and your family. And it's a great gift too. So let me play this. I loved this story for very different reasons. I just thought the story was so cute. And Matt Stresky tells a story, and the story is Violators Will Be Told. Violators Will Be Told. And this is about his daughter. And enjoy. This is Matt Stresky. Here you go.
My daughter Rain just turned 4 years old, and she has cerebral palsy. And luckily, her CP is considered moderate, and it basically affects her ability to balance and to walk. And because of that, she spends a lot of time in a wheelchair. And when you have a kid in a wheelchair, you find yourself feeling like you're moving through a world that isn't really designed with them in mind. It's like you're living just on the outside of these boundaries that typical people get to move seamlessly through. And when the doctor first gave my wife Valerie and I the news about this diagnosis, I had this knee-jerk reaction where I started thinking about all the things that she was never going to be able to do. I started creating all these boundaries for her. I thought, you know, she's never going to be able to take a long hike in the woods with me, and she's never going to go surfing with me, and she's never going to be the first female shortstop in Major League Baseball. And then there's all these physical boundaries that she deals with every day that push her to the periphery of a typical person's world. You know, it's uneven sidewalks, and it's always searching for a ramp or an elevator instead of being able to go up the steps right in front of her. And it's constantly waiting for the only handicapped stall in a bathroom while some guy needs extra elbow room. And, you know, as watching your kid having to deal with these boundaries, it can be really difficult for me. But on the other side of that, there's one space with clearly defined, well-drawn boundaries that its sole purpose is to make the life of a person with disabilities just a little bit easier. And it's a space that everyone in this room has looked at longingly at one point or another in their life, and it should be out of bounds to the able-bodied person, and that is the handicapped parking spot. And, you know, as a parent of a kid with a disability, I find it really frustrating and annoying when people leave their shopping carts in these spots. So I feel like it's my duty to move them whenever I see them. And one day I'm doing my duty. I'm moving these carts, and I pull the last one out of the spot, and this guy on a scooter wheels up and parks literally where I just moved this cart from. And I'm just furious. And as he's getting off of his scooter, I find myself saying a little bit more aggressively than I probably intended to, like, "You can't park that here." And he just looks at me like I'm a crazy person. And he says, "Yeah, don't worry, I'm just running it out real quick." And it just makes me even madder. And it's just like, every obstacle that has been pushing my daughter to the outside all this time has just physically manifested itself in front of me in the form of this scooter driver. And I just want to, like, tear this guy apart. But this weird thing has happened to me emotionally since I've had a daughter. And for some reason, when I get really angry, a lot of times I'll just start to cry. And it's really hard to project an aura of authority when you're crying, when you have just tears and snots coming out of your nose. And so, you know, I've thought about this so many times. I wish I said, you know, it doesn't matter how long you're going to be. These spots aren't for you. You know, move your scooter to another spot and be thankful you have two functioning legs to walk into the store. But I did not say that. Instead, I charged right up to him and I got into his personal space and I choked back my anger tears and I just said, "I'm telling." And he said, and he said, "You're telling?" And I said, "Yeah, that's right, I'm telling." And I spun around and I started walking towards the store to tell on this guy. And it just degenerated into this weird race, because then he started going towards the store and we both got inside at the same time, and I tried to look for an employee and he went to, like, buy milk or something. And I saw this assistant manager that I recognized, and he knew that I had a daughter in a wheelchair, and he saw what was going on in my face, and he was like, "Is everything okay? What happened?" And I just told on this guy so hard. I was just like, I was like, "You know, this guy on the scooter, he just parked in a handicapped spot, and he's not supposed to park in the spot, and I told him he's not supposed to park in the spot, but he's not going to move, and now he's in here buying milk or something." And he was just as shocked and appalled as I was, and he said, "Hold on a second, I'm going to take care of this right now." And he went over to the public address system, and he basically publicly shamed this guy, and he said, "You know, whoever parked their scooter in a handicapped parking spot needs to move it right now." And I don't know if the people in the checkout line, like, saw my face, but they all sort of rallied behind me, and they all looked shocked and appalled. And this one guy even audibly booed, which was really nice, I thought. And then I started scanning the checkout line to see if I could find the scooter driver so I could point him out to the mob and sort of, like, publicly shame him some more. And a few minutes went by, and I didn't see him, so I went outside, and his scooter was gone, and I felt really good because there was no way he was able to buy anything in that amount of time. And I felt really vindicated and invigorated when I left, because I felt like this group of strangers saw this injustice, and they rallied behind me, and they just wanted to help. And then I started thinking about all the obstacles that I was talking about earlier that Rain has to deal with on a daily basis, and I started thinking about all the people who offered to open doors for us or move things out of our way or just smile or give her a thumbs up as she's cruising around. And it made me feel like the world is full of good people who want to help. And then, you know, I know as her father, I'm going to have to, you know, defend her. But I'm also, as she gets older, I'm going to have to teach her how to stand up for herself. And I want to teach her that if she sees somebody acting unjustly, she needs to say something. And she also needs to accept people's help when they offer it to her. And that doesn't apply just because she happens to have a disability. And, you know, maybe she won't be able to take a long hike in the woods with me, but, you know, we're already teaching her how to ride a horse, so eventually she'll get in the saddle and we'll hit the trails that way. And we've already found these groups that do adaptive surfing, so she's already been in the waves and she loves being in the ocean. And, you know, she's probably not going to play shortstop in the major leagues, but most of your kids probably aren't either. And so, but when we go to the stadium to watch a game, she's going to have a great parking spot. Thank you.
Love it. If that resonates with any of you, and my heart always goes out to those dealing with I can't even imagine the challenge of a parent and dealing with that. And it seemed like everything kind of bottled up and there he was. And I just can so appreciate, where he was at with that. I work with special needs, and I've had some experience with this, and I'm telling you, it's, boy, you can sit there and just go, gosh, you know, you just feel for those parents. And I could certainly feel for him. I have one more for you. I'll try and squeeze this in. This is such a cute one. And this one is, Marco Herdes, talking about a hot dog. This is an extra hot dog. And sometimes it's just kindness, you know, not on the bully pulpit for kindness, but just kindness because we're all, you know, like the guy said in the last one, he said, you know, there's so many good people out there. And I agree. There are so many good people out there. This is Mark Herdes talking about his extra hot dog that he found.
So I was perhaps 16 years old living in Guatemala. That's where I grew up. I was raised in lower middle class family. My dad was an accountant. My mom, you know, stayed at home, but she always, you know, found ways of making money, you know, cooking or, you know, sewing or doing something like that. So they always provided for us. But we didn't have like extra money for, you know, things that we wanted to buy, you know, like allowance or something like that. So they encouraged us to find ways of getting money. You know, you can wash a car, you know, get at the grocery store or something like that. So the way I did it is I was very good in math, and so I became like a tutor for kids. So I helped them, you know, with their algebra and stuff like that. And that's how I made money. But of course, you know, the money that I made was just for me. You know, I didn't have to really use that money to help support my family or anything like that. So around that time, a lot of the gas stations very close to where I was living in Guatemala were changing. And they started selling more American food. You know, they had nachos with cheese, and they had these sodas and chips and all that stuff. And as a teenager, you know, in a third world country, you say, oh, American food, you know, I have to try that, you know. And of course, I had some money to do it. So one day, I saw that there was this gas station where they were selling these huge hot dogs, which I really like. And so I said, okay, I'm going to go and buy one. So I went, and I didn't get one, of course, right? I got two. And they were huge, right? Big bun, sausage, chili, you know, the works, everything in there. And so I came out of the store with, you know, one hot dog in one hand, the other one, I started eating one. And as I was walking on the street away from the gas station, I saw this man coming towards me, and he was walking with a kid. He was perhaps, I don't know, 10, 11 years old. And as they approached and they went past by me, you know, the kid looked at me, and of course he looked at the hot dogs. And of course, from the way they were dressed, I quickly picked up that they were, you know, poverty-stricken family, they were poor, and most likely the kid was working with his dad, so he might be like his assistant or something like that. So the kid looked at me and said, wow, these are great, where did you get them? And I said, oh, you can get them at the gas station. So he looked at his dad and like, you know, can we get one? And of course, and I just turned, you know, I look at the dad, and the dad had this face, right, like, you know, we cannot afford something like that. So at that point, I can assure you that I heard a voice in my head, and you know, something like, come on, man, you know, you have two, right? You just need one. You don't need two. One is enough. Give one to the kid. And, well, you know, I didn't do it. I just turned around and kept walking. But I can tell you that really there's something, you know, broke inside me, because that second hot dog didn't taste as good as the first one. And I remember very clearly that I walked that street for maybe the next couple of days up and down at about the same time, just hoping to find the kid again, and just, you know, making sure that I had another chance to do something that I knew I didn't do. But of course, you know, didn't happen. And I realized that, you know, this was one of those, you know, random opportunities that you have in that life gives you to assert yourself as a decent human being. And I clearly missed that opportunity that day. And it has haunted me the rest of my life. Thank you.
I remember that was Marco Herodas, An Extra Hot Dog. The first time I heard that story, I thought it was going to end great. I thought it was going to be a great story. And I remember thinking, wow, that's kind of a bad ending. So kind of like seeing a bad movie, you know, bad ending. And then I thought about it, and I thought about the message that he was relaying there. And to me, it hit me that that we have to follow our instincts, that we need to love, we need to serve, we need to serve our fellow man and have no regrets about it. And, you know, I know that probably a lot of you, had you been in the same circumstance, probably would have gone back to trying to search for that kid, trying to go, gosh, why did I not follow through with that thought? Why did I do that? I'm going back. I'm going to try. And he did. He tried. And he couldn't find that kid. And I've thought about that ever since, because that story impacted me in a great way to tell me to always follow that little voice, that gut feeling, whatever you want to call it. I call it the spirit, whatever you want to call it. And serve and love and do the things that you feel like I need to do this in that moment. Because I think, you know, having those kinds of little regrets and things like that, and we all have them, we could live with so many less of those and just really sort of revel in the service that we're willing to put out there. And I know there, all of you listening, there's just such a wonderful component about you as people, as good people that really just care. They really just want to do good things. And so my hope is that, and I've had moments like him too. I've had my extra hot dog moment where I went, oh, why did I not do that? And I always remember that. I always remember that when I hear that little voice say, you know, hey, you know, in that moment, do something, serve, love, do something now. And hopefully I'll never have another one of those moments like his hot dog moment. But hopefully it's a good reminder for us to look around, love, serve, and be good to one another. Be right back with Investigator Dave. We're going to be talking about global politics, jumping down the rabbit hole a little bit. Did some research last night that was kind of scary. Maybe we'll get to that too. Be right back.